welcome to Kayak Fishing the Wild West on your weeknight stop for kayak fishing information, kayakfishingradio.com. I'm your host, Dennis Spike from kayakfishing.com, joined by Northwest kayak fishing expert and co-host Isaac the Nothing Miller at the helm in Portland, Oregon. It is Friday, January the 6th, 2012, and welcome aboard. How you doing, Isaac?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. I got to tell you, it may be inspired by the new Kayak Fishing the Wild West intro, but I hooked up for tickets to see the Dick Dale Show in Petaluma, California. You remember Dick Dale, guitar, surf kind of music?
Yeah,
man, I think he must be pushing 80 years old, playing with his son at drums, but I'm excited because I've never seen him play before. And that very well could be inspired by you, so I want to thank you for an upcoming, what should be a wonderful show.
Yeah, sounds awesome.
Any kayak fishing going on, Isaac?
Not a whole lot. You know, it's the rain that I was waiting for last month has arrived all at once. So rivers have been swollen. They're coming down right now, so fishing's going to be good. You know, I still haven't bought my 2012 fishing license yet. So before I get out fishing, got to do that first.
I got to tell you, I went the other day, picked up a fishing license and the county parks pass. There's about probably 35 county parks, including Doran Beach at the head of Bodega Bay, where we do all our crab and launch for salmon. And I got to tell you, a parking pass and fishing license was well over $100 this year. Fishing license in California is $44 and change.
Wow.
I guess that's probably, online with what most other states are charging. And I'm happy to do it. For the most part, the revenue money from licenses goes to a good place, right back into the fishery. Lots of stuff going on here in California with the fisheries. I might as well get right in, if you don't mind, give you a quick report.
Let's do it.
As of January 1st, there was no more fishing in my backyard. Not saltwater fishing on the coast, though. If you want to go out and brave the seas for sand dabs or maybe a sole, maybe get lucky with a turbot or a flounder or a leopard shark, you could do that. But otherwise, the rockfish, lingcod, cabazon, that whole quadrant of groundfish is closed until probably the second week in June. It's going to be a long 5.5 months waiting on that to happen. But we're excited about it. It's going to be a good season. We had the longest season we've had in recent memory, and it was a good one. The spawn is on during winter, and some good fish have moved up. The crab are on again, off again, Dungeness crab. Price hasn't come down much in the markets. I'm seeing it regularly for about $5.99 to $6.99 a pound. So when we do get out there every other day when we seem to get a limit, that's 20 to 25 pounds of Dungeness crab. So that's not such a bad haul, even if you don't get them every day.
Yeah.
What else is going on around here? It's going to be a while before we start looking for fish. I've actually got an eye out for the giant squid. You know, the jumbo squid is actually what they are. And the big, they call them Humboldt squid because they exist in the Humboldt Current of the Eastern Pacific. And these are those big squids. I've talked about them before. They can get as big as 60, 65 pounds. Not only are they a good eating calamari, especially for one of my favorite meals, which is a calamari burger, but the jumbo squid makes sensational bait. In fact, it's such good bait, it's worth buying an extra freezer to store it in. It works great for fish. It works great for crabbing. And, you know, fishing a kayak, we tend to get a lot more days than most people. And I'm seeing it now where so many boats are coming down to Bodega Bay and the Sonoma coast around north of San Francisco to do their Dungeness crabbing. We got a lot of money involved in all of this and some real fancy crabbing equipment, too. And I look at the cost of driving your boat out to the coast, spending the time out here, waiting in line to get to the ramp, going out, and if you're lucky, getting your 10 crabs per person. A lot of these private boaters are only fishing one person. And I'm looking at us in the kayaks. who pretty much can slide in, check our pots or drop them before these guys get out of line and get their boats in the water and their trucks at a fraction of the cost. And I am just loving it. I heard from an angler in O'Brien, Oregon this week, which coincidentally is just north of my little cabin in Happy Camp, California. Happy Camp's a little town on the Klamath River, right before on the top of the state, right before the Oregon border. And this fella, he got the bug like the peanut butter hit the chocolate, man. And he's looking at boats and looking to get all the information he can. And for a guy who says he isn't very impulsive, he bought a couple of boats that he's looking to sell because he found me and got all the right models he needs to look at. And that's the way it goes. But you get hit with this sport sometimes, and it hits you pretty hard. You know, Isaac, I know you got closures going up there, and I want to ask you about them, but I did want to tell listeners that in Southern California, the Marine Life Protection Act implementation took effect in the Southern California region, and that has effectively closed popular fishing grounds in Malibu, not limited to Malibu and San Diego, particularly La Jolla, that have been appreciated by generations of anglers. And the whole Marine Life Protection Act itself is a slight and a travesty on recreational fishing and to anglers. And I don't know if there's any way to turn it around, but we really got to be aware, be proactive, be active with our lobbying groups. And I have been pushing KeepAmericaFishing.org very, very strong. They seem to be the real main line and lifeblood for all the regional fishing lobbies and getting a grasp on the biggest issues as they come down the pike. But it just blows my mind, and it makes me it adds another reason to the list why I'm glad I'm not living in Southern California anymore. Some of the fishing grounds that I've put hundreds of anglers on, introduced them to the sport of kayak fishing, I can no longer go to and fish my kayak. I can't fish anything. And it really is a shame, especially when California has a proven record in the last 10 or 12 years of leading the way in generating and moving towards sustainable fisheries. So it really is a heartbreak thing, and I implore anglers to get on the online and go to join a fishing club, find out who your regional lobbying groups are, who are those people who are out there fighting for your fishing rights and the rights to fish for generations down the line. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The Marine Life Protection Act in California was not done with science. It was not done with fishermen in mind. And I am absolutely convinced it was done with the end result, whether it's in my lifetime or their lifetime or down the road, to outlaw sport fishing, if not completely, as close as they can come. If you limit access enough, people will start fishing. And while I want to get your two cents on this, Isaac, I wanted to put some more input into this fishing closure thing, because I think what happens in California is just a mirror of what's happened in the past in Florida and the Eastern Seaboard, the Gulf, and other fisheries around the country. I belong to an email group called the Poets. And the Poets, I can't say on radio what Poets means. It means blank on everything, tomorrow's Saturday. And that means we're going fishing. And the Poets are a group that contacted me probably 15 years ago when the internet and email was just getting some steam. And it was some guys who had read some articles I had written for Pacific Fisherman Magazine and Western Outdoor News on kayak fishing. And they said, hey, we're starting an email group. All of them are people who own their own boats. All of them fish at least, or most of them fish at least once a week. Even though you own a kayak, we want you to join this group. And what the group of Poets did is reported the bite via email. It wasn't a club or an organization. It was just a gathering of people on with email addresses. And we reported the bite or lack of it pretty much from San Francisco down to the tip of Baja California. And it gave a lot of us, especially in its heyday, just another good report to go fish on or to stay away from and make a different approach. And when the MLPA took effect a week ago, or I should say 6 days ago, one of the poets posted that he's taken up gold mining, selling his boat, and since his favorite honey holes had just been outlawed for fishing. And these are honey holes that his dad fished and his grandpa fished. And then I started thinking about what we do, kayak fishing, and how many times, you know, the poets, as hardcore, these are as hardcore an angler as you're going to find. But again, they don't fish kayaks. They fish power boats, mostly their own, but they do charters and they do party boats too. And I'd say even the retired ones are lucky to get out 15 or 20 times a year, and 5, 7, or 10 is probably the average across them. Well, being in a kayak, you know, you get a lot more time on the water. And I've got to believe that this Marine Life Protection Act closure is going to drive more people into the kayaks for ease of access, affordability, and everything they read and see about kayak fishing being so productive. So while, and my whole point to all this rant, Isaac, and listeners, and I want to appreciate your hanging in there with me, is that while closures and the anti-fishing direction of social politics in America may dilute the numbers and the growth of sport fishing year in and year out, unless we do something about it, but that's what's happening now, I still believe that kayak fishing is going to grow as a section because a lot of the people who aren't being driven out of private boating and paid motorboat fishing are going to drive themselves into getting kayaks and getting on the water and once again find that they're getting a lot more fishing time in than they did before, even if their favorite spots close to home are no longer legal to fish.
Yeah. It comes down to the fact, you know, if you like to go fishing after work, it's a lot easier to throw the kayak on top of the car, go to work, go fishing, than it is to hook up the boat, go to work, find a parking spot for your truck and your boat, or leave work, get the boat, and then go fishing. It's just so much faster just grab the kayak, throw the kayak on the car, and away you go.
It and a fraction of the cost. And I got to tell you, looking at the bigger picture, Isaac, a lot of, you know, in, I want to say the old days, but it's not that long ago. It used to be you get off of work and in season you could find a twilight boat going out. Head boat, party boat, even a small charter that's taken a limited number of spots to go out and get on the evening bite. It just doesn't hardly exist anymore. You got a few stalwart, diehard operations like the Chubasco 2 in Point Loma, and you've got in Newport, the Oxnard Harbor, maybe Monterey. You got a few twilight boats going out, and I'm not sure it's inclusive of all those landings, but it's just an era that's come to an end. But it's not come to an end with a natural death. It's come to an end, like I say, with that anti-fishing social political movement. And I got to tell you, I hate to keep saying that, but I get fired up about this. So much of these closures, whether they've been in Florida, Cape Cod, New Jersey, or California, so many of these closures, I believe, are driven by people who want to privatize beaches. And since they can't privatize beaches in the direct way that they would want to, you limit access. There are so many places on the eastern seaboard that are wonderful areas, that would be wonderful areas, not only for us to fish, just for the American public to go and recreate at the beach, that the local communities have cut the access off, so you can't park within 5 miles of these beaches unless you live in those neighborhoods. And that
I know that's not the case here.
I'm sorry?
I know that's not the case here.
No, it's not the case here, but we are starting to see that in California. With Malibu being closed, places like Sea Ranch, a lot of the heart and soul of this Marine Life Protection Act, it would be hard to argue that they're not trying to keep people off the beach. And there's a long history of that. I've talked to sage writers like Bill Beebe, who used to write a column for the Western Outdoor News for decades. And I remember Beebe going down and doing some investigative reporting where the Malibu, the Los Angeles sheriffs took him off of a beach because they took a complaint from somebody who lived on that beach. It was a completely illegal thing to do. It blew up for the sheriffs and didn't help the residences too much, but this has been an ongoing battle. And as we know in America, battles are won with money and dedication. They're not always won with righteousness and justice.
Right.
And but if you can put that money and dedication on the side of justice, you're gonna, I believe you're gonna prevail more times than not. And I think that as kayak anglers, and especially for me, being in a position to make my livelihood here, my heart and soul and mission is to educate people, to educate their young people, to keep fishing a wholesome family activity and a traditional American pastime. And that's where I'm going with it all, Isaac.
Fair enough.
So, on the horizon, let me get back to our site. Who we got in the chat room?
Oh, we got Chip in there.
Chip, thanks for tuning in. Chip must think I'm the ghost of Kayak Fishing Radio. How did Chip's in the chat room. Isaac, did you get a chance to listen to the new Tuesday show?
I missed it. I was laying on a table with a bunch of needles in my back. So,
that's always a good thing, though.
Oh, yeah, it felt great. But I'm definitely going to be there next week for the Lozier's next show.
Good. I should be there, too, and I'm looking forward to it. Chip, welcome aboard. I hope everything's going good in lovely Atlanta. I hear it's been a cold snap going through the southeast. I haven't been getting much for fishing reports.
No, I've not heard a whole lot going on either.
You know, here in the they call us the North Bay, north of San Francisco. The striped bass should be chewing, but I haven't seen the reports. I know the sturgeon are chewing because Fish and Game just made a pretty remarkable poaching bust. And it was on a couple who had been under surveillance for about a year, and they were putting their skiff out in the San Francisco Bay system that's up behind inshore behind the Golden Gate Bridge. And they were caught in possession of, I think it was 35 baby salmon that they were using for sturgeon bait. That's not a good thing, okay?
That's multiple things going around there.
And but the fact that they're putting their money and energy into this, I truly appreciate it. And I don't think there can be any worse karma thing. You know, so what I was going to say is down in Southern California right now, when the fishing goes slow, you get into the winter months, you don't have as good a bass bite on the coast, when it gets hard to find halibut, and there just isn't a good bite going on for what you're used to fishing for. To fish crustaceans, there's not much of a crab fishery down there. There's a lot of red crabs and rock crab species. They're not. It's not as desirable a crab as the Dungeness is. There's no Dungeness down there. But you do have the spiny lobster, and I've seen some pretty big lobsters come out of that fishery. Down in Mexico, some of them go on about 25 pounds. And
wow.
But the lobster season hasn't been that good, and I see guys out on forums. Again, the lobster season, you can only fish at night. The Dungeness, you can fish 24/7. They crawl all the time. And, you know, best to look at your tides. That incoming or outgoing high tide seems to be when they crawl into your pots. But I saw that one of the fellas I had met on the beach, I don't know who he's tied in with, but he got hooked up with Cobra Kayaks. And they're doing an event over at Doran Beach, and I'll bet you they get 100 people or more. And it's just come on out with four pots, and we're going to award some prizes for the heaviest crab, the biggest crab.
Right.
And they're giving away a lot of prizes, a lot of crabbing gear and some other stuff. But they're giving away a Cobra kayak. And they're not charging any admission. They're going to take donations of food and crabs and do a big barbecue and crab boil. And I think that is just a fun, exciting event. And I'm starting to see more and more of this stuff pop up. And granted, there's always somebody behind it pushing something. But the fact that they can bring all these people to the beach with a free event for such a great time and give away great prizes, I think it just strengthens the whole sense of community that I see all the time in kayak fishing.
Agreed. That's nothing short of pretty awesome.
Yeah, it really is fantastic. And I got to tell you, you know, this sport in North America was really born in Southern California. That's where it got its roots. And not just with the people who are doing it. Now, granted, there everywhere you go, you're going to find people who are fishing a kayak long before anybody else who claims they were the first people to fish a kayak. And I certainly wasn't the first. This whole sport probably started, I mean, the modern era probably started with the longboards. Of which there are still a few great longboard fishing events around the country. But the modern era of the sport got started in Southern California, and within weeks of the first published article, it was at a fishing show, one of the biggest fishing and tackle shows in the country, and a lot of industry people got wind of it there, and that's where it grew. Those industry people based in Southern California really put a lot of steam, energy, and faith into this sport being a trend and not a fad. And now it is definitely a national sport. But when I moved to Northern California, I found that in Southern California, while you have a lot of anglers, it's very fractured as far as the community goes. You have a handful of websites that are regional in nature. And when you come north, you get to the NCKA and the NWKA, and it really brings the community together. And down in Southern California, even though you have a lot of places to fish and a lot of population, I just don't think people fish as much as they fish up here. And I've always said, and I don't mean this as a slight, but I've always said that outside of California, the consumers were always a lot more serious. The anglers were a lot more serious about getting into kayak fishing. And what I mean by that is to this day, 16 years into kayak fishing, I get calls from anglers who have called me 5, 6, or 7 years ago wanting to get into the sport. And then I get the call years later, I just bought a kayak. But when you talk to somebody who has a cold weather region, whether it's north of San Francisco or whether it's the eastern seaboard or the Midwest, when they have a winter, if they talk about getting a kayak, they're getting that kayak within 6 months. That seems to be my experience every time. And since I've moved up north, the sense of community is just sensational. And seeing all these little events pop up, the NorCal and Northwest websites are just wonderful community hubs for the sport, and I think that they make an exemplary example of what recreational fishing should be all about. Enough of that rant. Do you want to know what I think about people who post on websites awkwardly or inappropriately? I'm going to take a quote. I don't care if you want to hear it or not. The author's name is Andrew Keene. And one day, about 3 or 4 years ago, I was cruising through a bookstore, and somebody had written a book on the new age era of the internet, where it was now and where it was going. And that was Andrew Keene. And one of the quotes on the jacket of the book was, "I fear the consequences of a world in which the lines between fact and opinion, informed expertise, and amateuristic speculation are willfully blurred." Deep, huh, Isaac?
Yeah.
You know, whenever somebody gets up there and rants a point, I have always been, if I can go into another rant here, I have always been not an advocate. What's the opposite of proponent? I have been an opponent of wearing waders on your kayak. And the reason for that is when the discussions came up early on in the days of the kayakfishing.com forums, and everybody's got an opinion. There wasn't a lot of experience on forums and bulletin boards back in the late 90s, mid and late 90s. And I had to go through a lot of trial and error and experience and hate mail and making people mad and all that stuff. I had to go through a lot of that until a sense of maturity came to forums. And I think in a lot of places you don't see that, but in most places with solid community forums, even special interest forums like in kayak fishing, people have really grasped a sense and beyond the rules of a forum, because when forums started, people were, hey, it's my right to free speech and don't tell me what I can or can't say. But when the waiter issue came up, there was a guy who I'm sure he's long come and gone out of kayak fishing, but he took a real strong opinion about it, as did another guy who was making his career in kayak fishing. And somebody went as far as to make a video on why it's okay to use waders by jumping into a pool with waders on and saying, see, it's okay. But I got to tell you, I think that video was made just to counter my position. And that's just an opinion. I don't know that is anywhere near the truth, but I wouldn't be surprised. And people argued that point so ferociously, and I think only to be different than my opinion. The truth is, when the issue first came up, a guy I knew, his dad was at the beach surf fishing, wearing tight-fitting neoprene waders. He slipped, and a wave filled those waders, and he got into a need-to-be-rescued situation. And it was very, very scary for this guy to think he could have lost his dad surf fishing at the beach one day. Well, you get into bad seas, and you get tossed off your kayak, or you're on your kayak, and a big wave hits you and decides to pour itself down those waders. I think you got the same kind of situation. So I've always stuck with, don't do waders, especially in the ocean. I'm sure there's a lot of areas in skinny water where you can get to land real quick, where it's perfectly okay. But again, this came from an ocean-based point of view. And again, that's what brought me to Andrew Keen, the consequences of a world in which the lines between fact and opinion, informed expertise, and amateuristic speculation are willfully blurred. And why do people willfully blur them? To prove their point, even if their point isn't a good one. And when it comes to safety, I've always figured, if there's any issue, if there's a question, err on the side of caution. We don't want to do our dying on our kayaks. Mm-hmm. Thanks for letting me roll, Isaac. Did I lose you? Did I hear you snoring?
No. I didn't pick up the fly tying gear, though.
I'm sorry?
I didn't pick up the fly tying gear, though.
Oh. You know, the only other comment I have about wearing waders is if you're going to wear them, wear a darn good life jacket while you have them on the water.
Right. Now, when you talk about waders, are you speaking all waders or just the neoprene style waders?
No. You know, I'm not so much talking about – I'm talking about all waders, but I'm not so much talking about the neoprene. I'm more talking about the bib overall type waders.
Okay.
But the fact is that, you know, neoprene waders afford you about as much – a little less protection than, say, a Farmer John wetsuit. And I'm talking about compromised seas. I'm not talking about our normal bad days fishing. I'm talking about those days where you really got an issue and you got to be dressed for the occasion. And I think pretty much when it comes to recommending this stuff to anglers, you got to go with that worst case scenario. Chip, I see on the chat room you rolled in there with always wear your PFD. And you're right. I mean, when I first started, I was younger. I was cocky. Heck, I was young. I was cocky. And the first hate mail that I got, and I got a lot of it, was for articles that were being published in sport fishing magazines with people not wearing their life jackets. Now, all these were coming in from paddlers, traditional kayakers, and I agree with them. But back in 1995 and 96, if I only published pictures of anglers wearing life jackets, I wouldn't have had any pictures to publish. That's the way it was. And you're absolutely right. Wear your PFD. You know, I don't know if y'all saw in the news, this Australian guy took his kids fishing on his beautiful two-week-old new powerboat, and the boat caught fire and sunk. He was able to get the kids into life jackets and into the water. They were the helicopter showed up. This is off of Sydney, I believe. The helicopter showed up 45 minutes later, and there's the family of four hanging onto a cooler. And they threw them a life raft, and then a rescue boat showed up, and they weren't in the water very long at all. I think it was somewhere under 2 hours. But the guy got on board, and a few things that he said were that he said the first thing he said was, keep your EPIRB close at hand and know where your life jackets are. Because that was the first thing he did when he had an issue, was he hit that EPIRB and he got life jackets on the kids. And they will all live to fish another day. And you see the dad was a lot more shook up than what looked to be his 9-year-old. I think his 9-year-old still had a fun day, even though dad lost the boat.
You don't know better.
Yeah.
Well, you know, going back to the marine protection areas, I wanted to, you know, remind a few folks listening in, especially those in Oregon. Oregon has a few, two new marine protection areas, one of which I know for sure is a very popular area for kayak fishing. Anyone that's in Oregon has probably seen the video of a couple in their tandem sit on top kayak. It's on the Oregon public broadcasting pretty regularly. A couple go out in their tandem from Beverly Beach State Park. They paddle out to Otter Rock, catch a bunch of fish, and come back to the park, barbecue it right there on the beach. Unfortunately, Otter Rock is now closed. The Otter Rock Marine Reserve area starts off to the north at Gull Rock, which is about a half mile off the shoreline, and extends, oh, what is that, about 2 miles south to Whaleback Rock. Again, that's still about a half mile off the coastline, or off the beach there in the Beverly Beach area. So you're looking at about a total area of about 1 square mile. And it's an unfortunate thing, but fortunately for this area and for people that are fishing this area, there is a lot of other fishing immediately in that vicinity. So that part at least is good. But still, you know, any type of closure, like you said, is not necessarily the greatest thing in the world.
There's a lot of arguments for closing these areas, and a big argument is the pressure that it's going to put on other popular areas. The biggest gripe to me is that these closures are being implemented in the midst of state and government and anglers achieving sustainable fisheries. So the motives behind it are not only in question from an angler perspective, but they're highly, highly suspect. So when I talk about the dilution of sport fishing as an American pastime, this is what's happening. Points like areas like you're talking about, where young people went with their parents, who went with their parents, and now they're going to come back, and it's amazing how poorly informed anglers are. I talk to people in the Central Valley of California who come out here and don't know about changes in rules and regs, and while it is every angler's responsibility, you'd think that whether it's from a lobbying perspective, whether it's from a retail fishing perspective, or whether it's from a community perspective, that there would be some central venue, a clearinghouse for information, but there doesn't seem to be that. There doesn't seem to be a lot of both communication amongst anglers and media communication to anglers. But what's going to happen is these people are going to roll up, they're going to find their traditional spots are now closed to fishing, and they're not going to. A lot of them are not going to pick other spots. They're going to do something else because they don't know any better, you know.
Right.
Now some of them will, the diehards, but I don't think we can sustain recreational fishing on diehards. I think we sustain recreational fishing on the people who fish once or twice a year, and maybe not every year. And then at some point in their life, catch it like a bug. I think it needs to be as popular as bowling and video games and everything else. And I'm going to work hard to get it there, Isaac.
I know Oregon does a pretty good job of educating anglers as to what the current regulations are. They go around and they put notes up at all the popular boat launches and fishing areas saying, hey, you know, like Chinook season is closed or sturgeon is closed, or this is the new regulation on how to measure a sturgeon, which was the case the other year. They do a pretty good job at that, you know. This Otter Rock area really was a kayak fishing only type of area. It is really rocky. It gets really shallow. And, you know, unless you've spent a lot of time in there, you know, most power boats are going to end up in a lot of trouble in that area. I don't think that they were targeting, you know, the kayak fishermen or any fishermen, you know, by closing this area. But, you know, it certainly didn't help or didn't hurt most of the fishermen in the area by closing.
Right. So there is room for them to fish, and there is still access.
There is. There's plenty of room to fish. Like I said, it was a very lightly fished area, usually only by people in kayaks.
I think the best way to manage fisheries is by counting the fish and by doing the science and putting the money into it where we're taking the fish out of it. And the last 10 years in California has really recovered a lot of fish stocks and gotten them in that direction. And I think this is all the Alaskan model of fishing working its way down. Again, we have a social political movement that is very anti-fishing, and they've been looking for over a decade on how to work the judicial system and the legislative system, and they've been very, very successful because you can't find any proof and pudding for the fisheries behind what they're doing except closing areas to recreational take. A lot of people out there think the ocean should be an aquarium. A lot of people out there don't think we should be feeding the oceans. They are feeding people from the oceans. And they got a lot of money to put behind them, even though I believe that is a senseless, useless goal. If we look at some of our extreme environmental groups and what their missions are, they seem pretty useless too. But they sure do get a lot of steam, and they sure do get a lot of donations to keep on going. So we've got to be proactive as anglers, and I just can't say it enough. And we've been so behind the ball for so many years. And, you know, what you were saying about what Oregon Fish and Wildlife is doing with their website, with their communication to anglers, California has just gotten into the swing. We just got into the electronic licenses. They're easy to get. You can get them anywhere. And their website has gotten a lot better. But to find all the great fishing areas, to find all the fishing areas, to map out a plan, you still got to surf around quite a bit to find that information.
Okay.
I'm reading and I'm listening. Sorry about that radio silence.
Okay.
Give me some good news there, Isaac. Give me some hope for the future. Am I going to be coming up and doing some steelhead fishing with you?
Yeah, you know what? We had a huge amount of rain at the end of December, put a whole lot of water in the river, actually too much water in all the rivers.
Yeah,
fortunately, things have backed down quite a bit. most of the rivers are hitting perfect shape right now. I know southern Oregon coast, especially right now, is on fire. The Rogue River is one of them, Pacific, going crazy. Further up north here, things are picking up as we speak. I get more and more steelhead reports every day. So
nice.
Excellent time. Sturgeon is open in the Bonneville Pool of the Columbia River. Just about an hour out of Portland is what you got. How far you got to drive to catch some sturgeon right now this time of year? Still no word on what the rest of the sturgeon season is going to look like for the lower part of the Columbia and the Willamette River. We're still really crossing our fingers that things work out in that department. So, sorry, that's not exactly good news. What else is good news? You know, they're talking good numbers for spring Chinook this year. And,
they're talking about a good salmon season coming our way come April, too. And I'm looking forward to that opener. You know, as the years go on, we're getting more months every year to fish here on the Eastern Pacific. And that is just a sign of recovering fisheries. I was out surfing websites today, and I found USA Fish or FishUSA.com, which I think is pretty much an online tackle retailer. But they've got active bulletin boards, active forums there. And I went browsing through them just to see what the numbers were and where people are fishing. And their forums are pretty much Ohio and Pennsylvania, Great Lakes fishing, the big rivers like the Susquehanna. And this website forum had 23,000 registered members.
Wow.
Which absolutely blew my mind, you know. And it gave me another strong impression of how popular ice fishing is. But if you look at what's going on around the country, there's pretty much fishing, whether it's saltwater or freshwater, whether it's water or ice. You can find fishing in the U.S. 12 months out of the year. You might have to drive to some of it. But pretty much you can find fishing. And being in California, I'm pretty blessed because I fish, well, I've managed to fish or crab every month of the year for the last year and a half. And it doesn't look like it's going to slow down. We've got a bit of a drought going here. We're at about 30% of capacity for the rainfall we should have this time of year. We had a very, very wet season last season, which was good. And I don't think a lack of rain is going to hurt the salmon this year, but we need some rain here in California. And we've got about a 10-day forecast of clear skies and sunshine. And we need that to turn around. And it's funny, I don't know if it's my age or my concern for the environment, but I am pleading for rain. I'm ready to do a rain dance over here because we really do need it. You know, it's January. And the Sierras do not have a ski season going on, except for a few places that are making snow. And I think making snow means making ice right now. It's cold enough, but it is just not happening with the weather, and we need to get some snow. You know, I think they were skiing last October a little bit before the snow melted. We had some rain, but they were skiing last October in 2010 and skiing, I think, into July in a few places. But the difference a year makes, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
So what else is on the – I talked about there's a trip going to Christmas Island, a kayak fishing trip. And they think they're going to be fishing for yellowfin tuna, giant trevally, and some real incredible fish. I think Christmas Island, I know it's out there in the middle of the Pacific somewhere, and I'm pretty sure it's a military installation. And it just amazes me what's going on with kayak fishing and what I consider the tourist fishing opportunities. I might be into doing that Christmas Island thing. I'm also looking at Costa Rica and Panama. It's been a long time since I fished tropical waters, and I'm going to want to get back into that again. I'm not a big advocate of Mexico. Mexico isn't the same place that that it was when I first started fishing there in the mid 90s. And so I'm looking for some place that I have a little more confidence in to send anglers to. And Panama and Costa Rica are both looking like prime spots. But there are so many undiscovered kayak fisheries, or underexploited, I should say, kayak fisheries in the U.S. that I'm keeping myself pretty darn busy.
That's good.
So. I do want to come on down to the Everglades, and I look at it. I get all that Chokoloski email, and it's been a long time. I haven't done the Everglades yet, but I've been down to Fort Myers and Pine Island and Pine Island Sound, and that was such a nice area down there. I was able to get my first everything there. I got my first trout, my first redfish, and my first snook. And it wasn't a great day of fishing, and I don't know if you know the name. I got the lucky opportunity to fish with Ken Daubert, and Ken Daubert wrote the book Kayak Fishing the Revolution. It was the first kayak fishing book ever written, and Ken is also – do you know the name there, Isaac?
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
We've talked about it. Ken Daubert is also the co-inventor of the banjo minnow. And I think we talked about that on a previous show. One of those lures that really, really works. Like all lures, you just got to know how to fish it. How are we doing on time, Isaac?
Hey, you know, we're doing pretty good here. So.
All right. We're keeping a show going. I wanted to remind listeners that although this show is on the West Coast, we welcome all your questions and comments about the sport, and we want to hear from anglers everywhere. Log on to the chat room at kayakfishingradio.com or call in to the switchboard, and we'll put you live on the air, so to speak. What a great venue and what a great sense of community Kayak Fishing Radio is. I know there's a lot of listeners that tune in every night that they can and get a lot of great tips, and it's just amazing that I can hear somebody talk about fishing walleye or fishing drum, and something that they might say in the course of an hour teaches me something about fishing. But, you know, that's the only way I've ever learned. Well, is from experience, and, of course, watching what anglers who are catching fish are doing.
Yeah.
That has been my biggest tool. There are more times I've been on the party boat that there's a guy a couple spots down the rail hooking fish after fish after fish, and I've just stepped back and watched him hook up a couple of times, looked at what's going on, and it's amazing that sometimes the difference in a bite, whether you're trolling or drifting, fishing a live or a cut bait, the difference, and obviously I'm not talking about lure fishing, sometimes the difference has been in the type of leader or the weight of the lead. And I've changed using a Carolina rig with an egg sinker, just going down a quarter or half an ounce of weight has been the difference to getting bit. And I only would have learned that if I wasn't watching what other anglers were doing. And the particularities of fishing on any different day, unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
What else is going on? Big news. You heard about that big tuna? $750,000 tuna?
Yeah, I did hear about that.
Unbelievable. I think it was a 750-pound bluefin tuna, Atlantic bluefin, purchased by a Japanese sushi chain for, what was that, 750? Is that?
I think it was 734,000. Just short of three quarter.
So what does that mean? They're paying over $1,000 a pound?
Oh, geez, you know, I didn't even think about that.
How could that be? How could that be? Although I have heard you can easily spend $400 or $500 on a sushi dinner in Tokyo.
I don't doubt that one bit.
And I'll bet you're not eating a pound of Atlantic bluefin at that meal.
Yeah.
They're filling you up with a bunch of rolls, I tell you. What's going on in the fish market, Isaac? Is there anything new and hot or exciting out there as a hot tip for anglers?
Anything? Well, you got to keep in mind this is winter time. It's kind of the off season for
fresh fish.
Exactly, for Pacific seafood, anyway. Our halibuts and salmon are, quiet this time of year. So, we have some great sustainably farmed Arctic char coming out of Washington State.
Arctic char is a sleeper fish.
It is.
Now, are these farmed?
They are farmed. They are freshwater farmed just north of Seattle. And it's very nice setup they have going on there.
If you're promoting it, it's got to be a healthy fishery.
It is. It is 100% without a doubt. It's good stuff. So
I had only read about the Arctic char, and I'm going to look for some in the fish market next time I'm there. And it's pretty much a salmon, isn't it? Or salmon similar?
It's similar.
Like a red meat trout?
Exactly. It's just good. I just like it. It's not exactly. It's probably more closely related to, say, Atlantic salmon than the Pacific salmon. I don't know the exact breakdown size. What the scientists say. But that's the way I take it to be. And it's scaleless, which is really cool.
Like a trout.
Right. And it's just good eating. It looks
it
a
is.
Lot like
My
a
first
trout.
Experience with Arctic char, a friend of mine in Los Angeles has a native Alaskan friend who sends him once or twice a year a box of whatever she is. Shot or hooked on her rod, and one day she sent down a big styrofoam box of moose and char, and I liked them both. The char I was really, really impressed with. Not only is it great fresh and in the skillet, but there's so many things you can do. But you can pretty much treat it just like salmon,
exactly,
or trout.
What's great here in the Pacific Northwest is I referred a lot of people to steelhead. It's going to be probably the closest thing that you can buy at the store that's not actually steelhead. So
we got oysters and we got Arctic char. Is there a lot of that bay shrimp coming in too? That's always good
this time
of year.
That's closed this time of year. That closed in November. Yeah.
Oh, that's just a fall fishery then.
Spring, summer, and fall.
So everything we're seeing as far as bay shrimp is frozen and coming out of the warehouse.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
No, that's just fine. There are so many things. I think we're due to get a crate of Maine lobsters. Sent over. They taste different than the California spiny lobster, and they're always fun to have a dinner party or a barbecue with, crab boil and throw some Maine lobsters in there. But I'm starting to find that the way the shipping lobster thing has gone, it used to be that I called a little shop in Muscongas Bay, and they would take your order, they'd throw them in a box and FedEx them to you. But the cost of Federal Express has gone up tremendously over the years.
Yeah.
And these guys don't pick up the phone as much as they used to. Well, then I come to find that a lot of our supermarkets have got live Maine lobsters in the tank, and they're sometimes putting them on sale for under $10 a pound.
Right.
So I think, spending $50-$70 and going to the supermarket is going to be a fraction of what it would cost to bring these bugs in from the East Coast. But I think I got that on my palate, and that's going to come up pretty soon. I'm a big fan of old cast iron, especially the old Griswold cast iron. They quit making that stuff about 70 years ago, and it's real collectible. And I use it in the kitchen, and I just picked up a couple other pieces. They weren't Griswolds. One's an old Wagnerware, probably about 60, 70 years old. And it's a 2-quart deep fryer with the original basket. and then I picked up a giant oval roaster. And I'm just trying to think, how do I get a big ling cod into that oval roaster? Probably wrap them around, loop them in there on top of a big bed of vegetables, and then maybe a whole bunch of fresh tomatoes and that kind of stuff. Set that thing in a fire and let it go for a couple hours. I think it's going to be incredible. So I'm thinking at kayakfishing.com down the way here, we might see a whole page on cast iron fish cookery.
There you go. Great.
Are you drooling like Homer?
Oh, man. You wouldn't believe it. You would not believe it. I'm just seeing some of the best. Oh, yeah, it sounds good to me.
Nice. I look forward to hooking up with you. Oh, and the lobster rolls, too. You know, it's hard to sell a lobster roll to people on the West Coast. What's that?
If you've got any of that lobster left over, hey, send it my way.
I just might have to bring you down for dinner there. Yeah, they do a lot of crab rolls. When I was taking my new French boss down the California coast, we pulled into a little cafe in Pacifica, and I was shocked to see him order a crab roll. You know, I didn't know if he knew what he was going to get, but he absolutely loved it. Crab roll and lobster roll is basically just a sandwich, and it's not always fried crab or lobster. A lot of times they're just putting meat in there, but they are delicious. And old Bill, we're going to have to talk about that cast iron. And I would never put soap into one of those things. But, it really is a great, great source of cooking. And I was telling Isaac before the show, I just got an oval cast iron roaster big enough to hold a turkey. And it doesn't have enough markings on it to see how old it is. But I have a feeling it might have come out west on the back of a cook wagon. I'm really excited about that one with a nice snug fit and top. Anyway, I can rant forever, you guys. You want to bring us out there, Isaac?
Hey, you bet. No.
You guys okay with that?
Yeah.
I want to thank you all for joining us tonight on Kayak Fishing the Wild West on kayakfishingradio.com. We're on every night, Monday through Friday. You got a different show from a different region. We've got a new host. We've got a couple hosting the show on Tuesday night. And we look forward to your tuning in, your input, and giving you lots of good information on the sport. Thanks for tuning in, and go ahead and take us out, Isaac, Chip, all you guys. I look forward, old Bill, I look forward to fishing with you next, and I look forward to fishing with you soon. Have a great weekend and a good week.